You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome to another edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Thursday, March 25th. Our topic for today is freedom of speech. What are its boundaries? What are its limits? Or should there be any at all? Where does one of the central pillars of a democratic society have to draw a line between free speech and discourse that's hateful or offensive? In our current political moment, often described as divided and polarized, these questions, often discussed at length over the 232 years since the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, remain as relevant as ever. With us to discuss those and other related questions are two special guests. It's really a pleasure today to be joined by Michael Wassenaar, who is the president and CEO of the Alliance for Community Media, an organization which supports, promotes, and defends public education and government access television in the U.S., in other words, stations like GNAT. Michael, welcome to our program today. Real pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks, Andrew. It's good to be here.
We're also very pleased to be joined by Megan O'Rourke, who is the channel director for CCTV Center for Media and Democracy, which is based up in Burlington. Launched in 1984, CCTV Center for Media and Democracy's mission is to secure free speech and open the doors of local government for all. It is also a founding member of the Vermont Access Network, an association of 25 community media access centers that operate more than 40 channels and serve over 100,000 cable households in Vermont. Ms. O'Rourke, thank you very much for joining us today and making the time for this conversation. Well, Mike, just to get us started, let me begin with you, if I may. Since an article that you wrote in a recent ACM newsletter is what triggered the idea for this discussion in my mind, you wrote about a very interesting case of hate speech and community standards and access television that occurred recently in Lowell, Massachusetts, where a school board member there used an anti-Semitic slur to describe a former school administrator on a live morning program on one of the city's access channels. And as a result, local elected officials and community members forced him to resign from this position on the school board. And the question you posed to us was, should the program have been pre-recorded and all the unpleasant and anti-Semitic bits removed? Or how about playing a repeat of the program? Would you do that, you asked. So these are some really interesting questions, and they open up the door to a much broader conversation, which perhaps we'll have time for. But I guess let me throw that back to you. What would you have done if you were the manager of that Lowell station?
Well, I think the most important thing in that instance is that you need to have a community conversation about what's important in your community. And that's done on a continuous basis, and it helps you to helps provide a context for the understanding of community standards and responsibility that you have as an institution that should be open for all and embrace expression for all, right? So that's at the core mission of our work, and that has to be sort of front of mind as you're thinking about these types of issues. The problem, as I see it, is that that community was employing an anti-Semitic leader for probably and paying them a salary for, I don't know, close to half a decade. And they were actually elected by members of the public, right? And those anti-Semitic views weren't actually expressed in any campaign materials. That's not the way America works, unless, you know, we were really in sort of like a strange upside down political situation. It was only in the context of that live setting at 6:30 in the morning, locally, where this person revealed their thoughts and feelings about a former employee, and did so in a heinous manner. Right, exposing that through a live forum is actually a good thing to my mind, because it actually shows the contours of what's acceptable in our society. And that there was a public pressure placed upon this school board member to resign based upon their anti-Semitic expressions and views is a positive thing, right? And we want more debate and discussion about community standards and values in our society. We want to actually, I mean, so it's curious. I mean, I think very often when we're talking about political debate now in 2021, there's this term cancel culture that comes up as like, you know, oh my God, how dare you censor me? But I mean, we have always thought in communities that there are certain standards of expression at certain times and certain ways in which we express, which are perfectly acceptable in a free speech environment. You know, that's the reason why broadcasters, for example, think typically about safe harbor periods for mature content so that younger people aren't exposed to mature content. Certainly public educational and government channels across the country think about those types of community standards when they schedule programs at certain times of the day. That's appropriate. That's a way that we think about community standards as we empower more speech, not less speech. So the question about like sort of censoring or editing out content, I mean, it's a curious one. If that program had been pre-recorded and you have, it's, whose speech is it? Is it that person's speech or is it the editor's speech? Typically, if you're co-creating content, it's your responsibility as you're doing the editing and the publication. And then suddenly it's on you as the editor as to your responsibility to the public in terms of the content. So the thing that's kind of curious about that is that I wonder whether or not individuals or local governments, for example, would edit that out if it was pre-recorded rather than live, just because it doesn't fit a community standard. And then you take on an editorial role as an editor and a co-creator of the content. So it's a curious case. The thing that's interesting about Lowell is that I've talking with the folks that work at the channel, they had to navigate a lot of anger and upset over the expression, because people thought that it was the channel that was deciding that they were putting forward anti-Semitic content, even though it was done in a live setting, and they don't edit out live expression, right? So the channel had to do a lot of discussion with public officials, elected leaders, community groups, folks within the Jewish community, folks within various BIPOC communities within Lowell, because it's a very, very diverse community there in Lowell, Massachusetts, to say that, listen, you know, we are devoted to free expression. This was not our speech. And I think very often the public doesn't quite understand that, because we typically think that a channel on a television station is the expression of the company that's producing the content. And certainly by our commercial legal standards, that's the case in like 99% of the channels that are on American television. But it's not typically within a public access setting. Within a government access setting, it's typically governmental speech. Within an educational access setting, it's typically the educational institution speech. So there are different sort of standards of who's editorially responsible for the speech that goes on that people need to be thinking about. But certainly within a public access setting, it's the speaker's speech. So we have to keep constantly reminding folks of this, because it runs against the grain of, I think, 99% of what they see on television and certainly a lot of what they see on the internet, right? I mean, it's like, and I think this ends up being part of the debate that happens in our society about what the responsibilities of an editor are. Certainly it's the discussion going on right now about Facebook and hate content, or Twitter and hate content. So there's this, it's not an easy thing to decide, and it's a conversation that we have to be having with the communities that we serve constantly, it seems to me.
I'm really impressed that Lowell had the opportunity to have those conversations with so many community members, and it shows the power, I guess, of community access and the value of community access. I think when Mike is talking about live broadcast, we certainly show unedited gavel-to-gavel footage of meetings. And it's been sort of a hallmark, right? That's one of the places that I feel like is we are a trusted resource, in that you're going to see the unedited needing coverage of government access, where it becomes tricky for me. So, you know, I think in that sense, we would have done nothing. We would have allowed that broadcast to happen. We would have continued to share the unedited version, and we would have kept that in the archives, because I think it's really important for the community to be able to see. You know, I think speech is often harmful when it's hidden and not expressed, because it gives the chance for the community to respond. I think there's a role that community access can play in connecting, in making sure that people who need to see speech that is happening, I think there's a role that you can play. And I think this is different between public access and community access, because what you say, Mike, about community being this sort of set of standards that is unspoken, but that we all sort of agree on, right? But it's not unspoken, because people are constantly saying things that shift the boundaries. Where it becomes harder for me in the world that we live in here is the less obvious speech that is not that's not clearly hateful, but could be considered verging on dangerous speech.
Well, and I think that's where the debate lies right now. If many access organizations across the country abide by legal code within their communities, and typically say things in their agreements with local franchising authorities or local elected officials that they'll do anything that's legal, but they won't provide anything that's illegal on their channels. That's sort of like one sort of standard. Well, how does that work as society is changing? And even just when folks talk about hate speech, for example, we have notions of hate speech, but there's typically not codified hate speech in America because of Supreme Court rulings regarding local government infringing upon speech. So, you know, this entire question of like, what's dangerous, what's hateful is, it's extremely subjective. And we have to rather than having like a list that you look at and you check off the boxes, you have to be engaging with community in a respectful manner to determine where standards lie. And, you know, and very often we use the example of the shouting fire in a crowded theater as something that's a dangerous speech that can be regulated. And that's fair. But what's provocative?
Yeah.
What precisely are fighting words? Because those are sort of the standards that are used typically as a regulator on speech, certainly from government action, not from commercial action. The thing I think needs to be really kind of said here is that we're talking about government infringement on speech rights. Typically, when we're talking about First Amendment and free speech issues, we're not talking about commercial infringement. And commercial infringement, I think, goes way far beyond what government does, right? So, you know, the public discussion about these issues is so confused when you have people on the left and right complaining about Twitter. Twitter is a commercial vehicle.
But it also has the potential. So, and here's, you know, I'm curious what you think. I say sometimes, you know, Trump, to get political, Trump is a guy that should have just had a public access TV show. And he gained, you know, and I don't mean that to be self-deprecating about the role of public access, but he gained, and this is where dangerous speech, I think, is an interesting term that I think was coined by, I can't remember her name, Susan Belcher, maybe. She coined the term dangerous speech, and there's certain criteria. So having a national audience, having power, having a certain set of credibility, there's a whole series of criteria that I think you gain. And the question for me becomes, you know, we've gone through this period of COVID, And we've begun to develop some community standards around something like masks, wearing masks, right? Although it's different in different communities. I'm in, you know, up here in Vermont, you know, everybody wears masks. It's not that big a deal. Nobody, you know, like maybe in some parts of the community, somebody gives you a funny look if you don't have a mask on or if you do have a mask on, right? So when we have folks, and we do have folks who are doing shows, not public meeting shows, but like regular shows that are challenging, saying, oh, you know, you don't have to wear a mask because asymptomatic spread doesn't exist. It's not real. It's a hoax. What is the role then that we play beyond the standard disclaimer, which is what we're doing, right? We add a standard disclaimer. What is the role of community access?
Well, I would make the argument that our role is actually providing accurate information for communities to be able to live their lives in a free way. So, I mean, that's the reason why you should be having a public health program on a regular basis with public health officials communicating with folks in their communities on their terms. And I think that means it's incumbent upon the channel operator to be seeking those sources of information and cultivating information that's useful for people, as opposed to being a passive conduit. The metaphor of a conduit, the channel just being a conduit for people's behavior, is destructive in some respects, because it basically allows it, while it's an out to a certain extent for responsibility that you have in terms of your actions, it's an out in terms of your responsibility to the community that you're a part of. And theoretically, the channels are there to be able to meet community needs. That's why they exist as a result of the Cable Act, not because of free speech, because of community needs, right? That's the key within the franchising process, typically at both state and the local level. And that's the core of the community it's the core of the 1984 Cable Act. It's community needs that drive the resource, not the need for free speech.
Well, I think,
right? This is the thing that kind of gets us all kind of tangled up. I mean, like, we were talking a little bit about this case that's happened recently in the Supreme Court about private operators of public access channels, of the Halleck versus MCAC case, and what, you know, are the channels free speech forums, or are they public forums?
To explain that just a little bit. So Manhattan Neighborhood Network, there were some folks that were doing a show, and they were banned. They were locked out.
They were locked out. They were banned because the producers contended they were locked out because of their expression in criticism of the organization. Yeah. The organization claimed that they were being locked out because of behavioral rules. Right. And, you know, our argument all along has been, yes, as an organization, you can have behavior rules to make sure that people are not abusive, violent, destructive of property, or abusing the privilege of say, for example, you know, using a camera or a studio, or working with others. You're not free to be a racist and produce a program and be abusive to people in an access environment. That you've got the ability to create an environment that's conducive to expression, and it's necessary to a certain extent. Well, you know, the Supreme Court basically said that as a private operator of the channel, the private operator is a publisher and can choose its publications as a result, and is not a public forum. And I guess at a certain level, I agree with the logic, but at another level, I think it really fundamentally gets wrong the role of what a public access channel can and can't be in America, right? I mean, so, you know, can a private operator host a public forum and act in a fair fashion to ensure that everyone's rights are respected?
Yeah.
Yes. And it happens every day in America. Yes.
And it's when we function the best, right?
Correct. But I think there's this confusion also in the ruling about my speech rights and my ability to be able to work with others or not work with others. So I think there's this whole question of sort of, you know, the behavior of folks within a facility, and do you have the ability to be able to police that behavior? I think clearly you do. I think the Supreme Court says yes, you do, but I think they confuse the channel with the operation of the organization. You know, and it's just it's I just think it's an unfortunate ruling in a whole host of levels, and it doesn't really help us as we're moving forward. You know, I think we need to be finding ways to be able to codify ways that we're working with folks to have more speech that's useful for folks. And freedom of speech is a way to be able to, I mean, I talk to people within sort of communities of color all the time. Freedom of speech is a way to ensure that you are building freedom.
Every rule that we make, I mean, I think every rule that we make to inhibit speech for one group will eventually be imposed on any group, you know, or can potentially be imposed on any group. And that's what's interesting to me about that Manhattan Neighborhood Network is it's like the folks that were speaking were not, you know, they weren't prohibiting offensive views. You know, in that case, I think the community standard of allowing folks to express themselves in a community platform, I don't think it was met.
Yeah, well, I think there's this issue of whether or not the facts are being argued or the law is being argued, right? So, I mean, I think there's a factual dispute between those parties and the law is totally different.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that ends up being the other issue here that I think is kind of, I mean, if anything, I think there's an argument for binding arbitration between parties rather than actually taking things up to the Supreme Court, but that's just me. So, at any rate, you know, so to get back to this question of sort of boundaries of speech, I mean, I think the question, I mean, there are boundaries of speech that we exhibit every day. The question is whether or not they're reasonable. Right. And this gets kind of back to Andrew's question, you know, is what's reasonable for us as we're moving forward to support our communities and provide them information that's useful in their lives and information that's useful for our democracy.
Yeah. And then who has that and the power and the resources to set those standards? So I think your idea of the community standards is very interesting. And certainly at the start of the pandemic, as an example of that, you know, we said our role as community access is to make sure that the most recent information is getting out. It's getting out in a variety of languages. We have our channel ticker that we are expressing, you know, the highest quality standards that we can. And again, in Vermont, I feel like we had some really good leadership. We had some really good science. We had folks that, you know, we felt like their message, we could amplify that message. And then when it came to my attention, this other content that was going out, I felt perfectly comfortable in the confines of our community to actually put on the screen, you know, some of the content in this goes against CDC standards, you know, or goes against, and I chose to do that in that context, in, you know, but it also with the resources of community access, we're just limited. You know, like, do we watch every piece of content that comes through our door? Do we have fact-checking capacity? Should we do less and do it more accurately? I mean, I think these are questions that become, and again, it's specific to community access, not public access.
Well, I respect what you're saying. I think when I was operating a channel in St. Paul, I would hear questions about content that was questionable all the time. Not all the time, maybe once a month.
Yeah.
And I would often tell people that, well, listen, this is a public forum. would you be interested in creating a program that we can schedule right after that program?
Correct. Yeah.
Called what the hell was that?
Yeah.
Or would you be interested in using our resources to be able to correct the record?
Yeah.
Because we think it's in our interest that your voice be heard. And 9 times out of 10 people wouldn't do it.
Well, there's also an argument that if folks don't feel comfortable, if you have created a hostile or uncomfortable right. environment, do people want to come in? And that's been, you know, yeah. a conversation that I've had with staff members who are in the 35 and under range, I will say.
Well, I think that's correct. And I've heard that in multiple communities across the country where a public access producer takes a camera, goes into a community meeting and disrupts it. And then, you know, the organization, which is devoted to civic expression, is known as the folks where, you know, the folks where that jackass is. Well, that's the jackass organization.
No.
It's probably a stronger word that they use. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, so I think the leadership question for the organization is how do you build greater civic connection? How do you build greater civic resiliency? How do you strengthen democracy? Free speech is just one platform. It's not the only platform to be able to do that. I mean, it's one value. It's not the only value. And yeah. we suffer when we only are talking about one value, not many.
Exactly. Yeah. And what's the most important forefront? Can you swap out the most important value that your organization is leading with at that moment? Or do you, you know, for us, it's free speech and open government. But free speech has also become, it's become hijacked in a certain way by in a certain ideological background. That's what it feels like right now. Whether or not that's temporary, because it's an important underpinning of our democracy.
Mm-hmm. What about social media? I mean, Facebook, Twitter, and all of that. A different platform from public access TV, but it seems like anything goes on social media. Is that right?
I don't think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, there are standards of expression and there is monitoring that occurs, whether it be takedowns of commercial violations, for example, that you find on platforms like YouTube that monitor for commercial rights violations, to, you know, hateful trolling, bullying on Facebook, to, you know, death threats on Twitter, things like that. I mean, I don't think it is a sort of like, I mean, I think the problem with those platforms is it's very, very hard to know how, as a community member, you have the ability to be able to engage with it, because it's like a big it's like a multi-billion dollar industry with billions of people. What does community mean?
Exactly.
We have a much better chance to be able to think about community expression and engagement at the local level as an access channel. To get back to this question of community standards, I just think that we can provide something that's much more real for people in their lives than this question of like community standards globally, on Facebook, for example.
Yeah, I think community access exists inside community. It depends on community, which means neighbors, and neighbors are people who don't share. They share geography more than they share anything. They don't share, may share culture, but they don't have to share an ideology. They don't have to share points of view, but they do have to share the space that they live in. And I think that is really, really what distinguishes us from social media. And, you know, one really interesting exercise is to go to YouTube and just try to find your community content in something like YouTube. And that curated content that I call non-siloed content, because what social media does is it builds silos of people that either agree with each other or, you know, their ideas are reinforced. And those algorithms that are created, whether those folks know about how those, you know, whether somebody actually knows exactly how those algorithms work, their final role, their final the final destination is money in the pockets of the people that are funding it. So that's either money in the hands of Facebook or money in the hands of the people that are advertising on those platforms. And that's really different than the final goal of community media, which is to connect neighbors to each other and to the democratic processes that we have access, you know, that we can make a difference in our lives. So
we'll see you again the next time.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.